Safe as we believed on our side of the Atlantic, most of us listened to these staggering events in a sort of daze, numbed by the power and ferocity of the German war machine which had captured Paris a bare month after the Blitz began. A week later, the French were made to surrender in the same railway car where they had taken German signatures of defeat a generation before. France was to be divided into an occupied North and a Vichy puppet South. At the scene, Hitler danced with glee. His Air Marshal Goering glanced across the channel. Britain stood alone. Churchill, magnificent realist, spoke to his nation and the world.
What General Vagon has called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Upon it depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire. The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be freed, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty. So bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
There were powerful forces here at home struggling to keep us out. Despite them, the first draft law ever passed in peacetime went through Congress. The president spoke at a ceremony which was punctuated by the agonized cry of a mother who knew there was a call for her son.
Secretary of War will now draw the first number. The first number drawn by the Secretary of War is serial number 158.
Forward! Hut! 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 Hut!
Air hero Lindbergh gave the view of America First for drawing in, isolating against involvement.
These wars in Europe are not wars in which our civilization is defending itself against some Asiatic intruder. There is no Genghis Khan or Xerxes marching against our Western nations. This is simply one more of those age-old struggles within our own family of nations. If we enter fighting for democracy abroad, we may end by losing it at home.
With the summer of 40, a presidential year, came the national political conventions. Robert Taft, bearer of a great White House name, would be the Republican candidate. The party regulars had barely heard of a rumpled corporation lawyer from Elkhart, Indiana. But the people in the balcony there in Philadelphia that summer knew about Wendell Willkie and let themselves be heard.
I stand before you without a single pledge or promise or understanding of any kind, except for the advancement of your cause and the preservation of American democracy.
A political upset. Willkie won the nomination. 2 weeks later, in Chicago, the Democratic fight was over a tradition as old as the nation. Could there be a third term for a president? There hadn't been one since Washington's farewell address had set up the ban. There never was any doubt. With war abroad, the nominee had to be FDR.
At this particular crisis in their history, the New Deal Party captured the Democratic Convention at Chicago. It went through a transparent rigmarole about drafting a candidate for president.
The overwhelming majority of Americans will not be scared by this blitzkrieg of verbal incendiary bomb.
Radio had made the public celebrity conscious, and the political campaigners on both sides took advantage of it. Here are three Lewises.
Champion Joe Lewis, pro Wilkie.
I'm voting for Mr. Wilkie because I think you're going to be good for my people.
Champion novelist Sinclair Lewis, pro FDR, as he invades Wilkie's hometown.
People of Elwood, it looks to me like it's going to be a hot time in the old town tonight.
Labor champion John L. Lewis, anti-FDR.
Personal craving for power. The overweening, abnormal, and selfish craving for increased power is a thing to alarm and dismay.
And champion campaigner FDR.
He is one of that great historic trio which has voted consistently against every measure for the relief of agriculture, Martin, Barton, and Fish.
In November, the electoral vote was 449 to 82, a clear FDR mandate. The president, speaking of the four freedoms, returned to his recurring international theme.
Never before, since Jamestown and Plymouth Rock, has our American civilization been in such danger as now. We must be the great arsenal of democracy.
What is the answer that I shall give to this great man? Give us the tools, and we will finish the job.
But the job was truly a tough one. The doleful wail of an air raid siren became the newest of the new sounds of the 40s. In September, Goering's Luftwaffe set out to soften up England for invasion by waves of bombers, hundreds of Hankels droning up the Thames nightly to London or to Birmingham and Coventry. The Battle of Britain was an epic of courage. Barrage balloons, fighter pilots, and the dogged courage of the man in the street turned them back. Thwarted for the moment in his invasion plans, but controlling the continent, the Mediterranean, and the Atlantic, Hitler turned east, tore up his Treaty of Convenience, and invaded Russia with his full might in June of 1941. It may have been his biggest mistake. During the past year, tension had been increasing between the United States and Japan. The third of the Axis partners, from Tokyo, had been pressing their Greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere through China and Indochina. The U.S. had frozen Japanese assets, then scrap iron imports. By November 14, Secretary of State Cordell Hull seemed to have exhausted negotiating area with the regular Japanese envoys. That day, Saburo Kurusu, a special envoy, landed at San Francisco. Even he didn't know he was a decoy.
You all know how difficult my mission is, but I'll do all I can to make it a successful one for the sake of two countries, Japan and the United States.
December 7th, 1941, Sunday. Reading the Sunday supplements, listening to the radio, snoozing.
From the NBC newsroom in New York, President Roosevelt said in a statement today that the Japanese have attacked the Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, from the air. I'll repeat that. President Roosevelt says that the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii from the air. This bulletin came to you from the NBC newsroom in New York.
The White House also reported today an simultaneous air attack on Army and Navy bases in Manila. This report followed the President's declaration that all Army and Navy bases on the island of Oahu in Hawaii are now under air attack.
Here is what has happened. President Roosevelt phoned Secretary Early half an hour ago that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, the United States naval base on Oahu Island in the Hawaiian Islands. This means that war is underway between Japan and the United States.
Hello, NBC. This is Bert Salmon speaking from Manila.
Manila has just been bombed. In fact, right now it is being bombed. And without warning, Japanese bombers started bombing Fort William McKinley, Nichols Airfield, and the RCA transmitting station. At 3:09, without warning.
December 8th, 1941. The Joint Houses of Congress. FDR appears on the arm of his son, Marine Captain James Roosevelt.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
The next night, the powerful unifying pull of a somber fireside chat.
My fellow Americans, the sudden criminal attacks perpetrated by the Japanese in the Pacific provide the climax of a decade of international immorality. Powerful and resourceful gangsters have banded together to make war upon the whole human race. Their challenge has now been flung at the United States of America. The Japanese have treacherously violated the long-standing peace between us. Many American soldiers and sailors have been killed by enemy action. American ships have been sunk. American airplanes have been destroyed.
Now we're at war. We're all at war. On December 11th, Germany and Italy had declared war on us. The Allies against the Axis. The closest of bonds were needed between us to help match the enemy strength. They controlled all of Europe, the Far East, and most of the sea lanes between. We were underdogs in a true world war. At Christmas, Winston Churchill conferred on strategy in Washington with FDR and made a memorable appearance before the joint houses. We were called his mother had been American-born.
What kind of a people do they think we are? Is it possible they do not realize that we shall never cease to persevere against them until they have been taught a lesson which they and the world will never forget? By the way, I cannot help reflecting that if my father had been American and my mother British, instead of the other way around, I might have got here on my own.
1942 saw the beginning of an enormous tulip of America's industry. Planes, ships, and guns in incredible numbers to pull even with the fascist buildup and to supply a two-ocean war. There had to be defeats at first. They came hard and heavy. Our forces in the Philippines were surrounded on Bataan Peninsula and then on Corregidor Island. In the midst of negotiations with the Japanese, General Jonathan Wainwright suddenly called for an army transmitter. There followed a high point in our war annals in dignity and humanity.
This is Lieutenant General Wainwright. Subject, surrender. It became apparent that the garrison of our forces would be eventually destroyed by aerial and artillery bombardment and by infantry supported by tanks which have overwhelmed Corregidor. After leaving General Homer with no agreement between us, I decided to accept, in the name of humanity, his proposal. You will therefore be guided accordingly and will, repeat will, surrender all troops under your command to the proper Japanese officer.
This decision on my part, it was realized, was forced upon me by means entirely beyond my control.
The death march of American prisoners from Bataan became an epic of courage.
We started the death march in groups of 100, about 3,000 or 4,000 of us in the line, marching by fours. About 3 Jap guards to 100 of us. Didn't see any officers. Mostly those superior privates of theirs, men with 2 or 3 stars in their uniform. They'd slap our soldiers across the face, beat them up. I saw one of our men carrying a new pair of shoes. He sat down to take off his old shoes. The Japs came up and took away both pairs. That lieutenant walked 7 days in the death march, and when we arrived at the end of the journey, he didn't have feet, just a mass of infected blisters.
The turning point came in the Sea War, beginning with the Battle of Midway in June and the bloody 6-month struggle for Guadalcanal that followed. Now began the agonized series of amphibious attacks on Jap-held islands, leapfrogging the Pacific to get within bombing distance of Japan. Exotic Pacific Atoll names that became bywords for combat courage, especially for the Marines. Tarawa and Truk, Saipan, Tinian, Kwajalein.
Just landed here about 15 minutes ago, and I don't know whether I sound scared or not, but I am. I don't know if you can hear any rifles popping or not, but there's rifles and just everything in the book is going off around this place. Namur Island, down in the Kwajalein, and boy, this is really a hot place. And these guys just keep coming over here, boy, and they come awfully close, awfully close.
In the European War, too, the tide had turned for the Allies, beginning in October of 1942 with Montgomery's victory at El Alamein, which stopped the thrust towards Cairo and the Suez Canal of the German General Rommel, the Desert Fox. We mounted an amphibious operation all the way across an ocean, from Virginia to North Africa, which joined with the English to finally force Rommel's surrender in May 1943. With Africa secure, began the drive across the Mediterranean to Sicily, then over to the Italian peninsula, with bloody battles at Salerno, Anzio, and Monte Cassino. Italy surrendered in September of 43, but the Germans took over at once and defended it tenaciously. Into this setting, in mid-1944, with Europe still Hitler's fortress, was thrust the biggest invasion in history, the Allied Expeditionary Force across the English Channel, Supreme Commander Dwight D. Eisenhower. 18 months in preparation, the assault was launched on June 6th, D-Day, with 600 warships, 4,000 supporting craft, and almost 200,000 men. They faced 15 German divisions behind the heaviest of defenses on 40 miles of the beaches of Normandy. For months, the world had sensed an invasion was due. But when and where? First word came from Eisenhower himself.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man-to-man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck. And let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
And again, the Supreme Commander, this time to the peoples of Europe.
People of Western Europe, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of the concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe.
At home, the president led the nation in prayer.
Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. With thy blessing, we shall prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogances. Lead us to the saving of our country, and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace. Thy will be done, Almighty God.
As the landing craft were coming in to Utah Beach and Omaha Beach, a combat correspondent on a transport ship gave the most famous on-the-spot description of the war. George Hicks.
Here we go again. Another plane's come over. Right over our port side. Places are making an arc right over our bow now. They're disappearing into the clouds before they burst. Looks like we're going to have a night tonight. It's falling down through the sky and circling down. Maybe a hit plane.
Here he goes.
They got one. They got one.
We got that one. It's down right here.
Did we?
Yeah.
For this one? Great blotch of fire came down and is smoldering now just off our port side in the sea.
The lights of that burning Nazi plane are just twinkling now in the sea and going out. When the tracer starts up again and there's warning of another plane coming in.
D-Day has been called the longest day of the war. But courage, backed by giant reinforcements in the week that followed, led to victory in Normandy. Now began the battle for France, the beginning of the Allied drive to Paris and on to the Rhine. Liberate Paris by Christmas and none of us can ask for more, said Churchill to Eisenhower. But Paris was liberated on the 25th of August, 4 months earlier.
This is John McVane in Paris. Those bells you can hear are the bells of Notre Dame Cathedral. They've just begun ringing about 2 or 3 minutes ago, and they're ringing a chime of thanksgiving that French troops have entered the city. We just came in this morning with the first correspondence, the first American car to come in with these French troops, and we've just had a big street fight here right in the square in front of the cathedral. And now all the church bells in the city are beginning. I can hear 3 or 4 more churches. And
General Charles de Gaulle, head of the new French provisional government, went to Mass at Notre Dame to celebrate the liberation of Paris.
The general has now turned to face the square, this huge crowd of Parisians, being presented to people. It's being received. Even while the general is marching
into the cathedral. Well, that was one of the most dramatic scenes I've ever seen. Just as General de Gaulle was about to enter the Cathedral of Notre Dame, firing started all over the place. I'm afraid we couldn't get you the noise of that firing because I was overwhelmed by a rush of people who were trying to seek shelter, and my cable parted from my microphone. But I fell just near General de Gaulle, and I managed to pick myself up. General de Gaulle was trying to control the crowds rushing into the cathedral. He walked straight ahead into what appeared to me to be a hail of fire, but he went straight ahead without hesitation, his shoulders flung back, and walked right down the central aisle, even while the bullets were pouring around him.
Yet there was no doubt the Allies were on their way east to Hitlerland. At home, that summer of 44, it was time for a presidential campaign. FDR's fourth term bid challenged this time by Governor Tom Dewey of New York. The old campaigner, war-weary but confident of victory and determined to stay as commander-in-chief until the world battle had been won, took to the campaign road again.
These Republican leaders have not been content with attacks on me or on my wife or on my sons. No, not content with that. They now include my little dog, Fowler. Well, of course, I don't resent attacks. And my family don't resent attacks. But Fowler does resent them.
This is a campaign against an administration which was conceived in defeatism, which failed for 8 straight years to restore our domestic economy, which has been the most wasteful, extravagant, and incompetent administration in the history of the nation, and worst of all, one which has lost faith in itself and in the American people.
FDR was elected, 432 electoral votes to 99 for Dewey, who carried 12 states. Now, sensing the nearness of victory and the great post-war problems, the Big Three, in February of 45, secretly got together at the Russian seaside resort of Yalta in the Crimea. FDR, Churchill, and Marshal Stalin. A month later, a noticeably older president reported on the Yalta meeting to Congress, for the first time not standing on his iron-braced legs, but sitting down. You could tell there was a difference in his voice.
I hope that you will pardon me for an unusual posture of sitting down during the presentation of what I want to say. But I know that you will realize that it makes it a lot easier for me in not having to carry about 10 pounds of steel around on the bottom of my legs, and also because of the fact that I have just completed a 14,000-mile trip. Speaking in all frankness, the question of whether it is entirely fruitful lies to a great extent in your hands.
It was April 12th, 1945, when the flash came around 5:30 in the afternoon.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin from CBS World News. A press association has just announced that President Roosevelt is dead. The president died of a cerebral hemorrhage. All we know so far is that the president died at Warm Springs in Georgia.
If you are over 30 years of age, you can probably remember just where you were and what you were doing on that Thursday afternoon when the flash came. I was in Studio 3A in Radio City preparing material for the upcoming UN conference in San Francisco. That flash marked the end of an era and of the dominating presence of a national leader who had spoken for our nation for over 12 years.
The drums are wrapped in black crepe and are muffled, as you can hear. And the pace of the musicians is so slow. And behind them, these are Navy boys. And now just coming past the treasury, I can see the horses drawing the caisson. And most generally, folks having as tough a time as I am trying to see it. And behind us is the car bearing the man on whose shoulders now falls the terrific burdens and responsibilities that were handled so well by the man to whose body we're paying our last respects now. God bless him, President Truman. We return you now to the studio.